Blog Talk Radio.
Live from the nation's capital, it's Quintessential Listening, Poetry, with host Dr. Michael Anthony Ingram.
Tonight, our very special guest is Naomi Tears. Naomi, are you with me?
Yes, I am. Good evening, Michael.
Fantastic. Great, great, great. A quick question first before we begin. Why do you believe that poetry is important? Why is poetry important?
Well, it's not really a quick question.
All right.
I don't have a quick answer.
All right, no problem.
But that's a terrific question. That really is. Well, I think poetry is kind of, it's like music. What happens when you experience it? Something kind of opens up inside you, and it kind of bypasses maybe our analytical mind, our conscious mind, gets you to perceive things a little differently, you know, because of the meld of the sound and the meaning. I feel like it bypasses some barriers. But I also think something people don't really think about enough is poetry just brings delight to life. It brings energy. You know, we often hear it's kind of like it's taught like it's just some kind of puzzle or, you know, some torturous, hard thing. Poetry brings energy and joy. And I'll just close with this because I know you wanted not a long answer, but there's a quote. I carry this quote with me because I love it so much, from the poem Jimmy Santiago Baca. And he says, when you work on a poem long enough and just do that one poem and don't worry about anything else, the imagery of one verse line will exude a sparkling fountain of energy that fills your spirit. And I just think poetry brings us energy for the reader and for the writer.
That's very nice.
So
very
I think
nicely stated.
It is important. Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, what I'd like you to do at this point is to share some of your work.
Absolutely. I think I'll start with a poem I wrote for a friend of mine who died about a year ago. I have a lot of poems about women that I've known. So this is for a friend who I used to work with and is also a visual artist. And it's called All or None for Carolyn. Integrity was never so buoyant. The hand of giving and of fairness never so light, so angled in a joyful invitation to dance as with you, friend. It wasn't only in the swirled yellows, greens, and ochres of your paintings, the African heat and mystery of your missionary childhood, that you gave your all, drenched everyone in your vision. It was all or nothing with you in your cooking, your art classes, even your day job. The writers you edited felt they had been knighted, just as you gave freely to your children, two birthed, two adopted. When your mother invited to visit each summer, just the two natural ones, you said, they are all my children. Invite them all or none. Carolyn, you loved like the equatorial sun, rays of joy refusing to leave anyone in shadow. Shall I read another? Thank you.
Yes. Let me ask this question, though. How does a poem begin for you, with an idea, a form, or an image?
That's a good question, too. I'm going to say a little differently. It often begins for me, I think, sometimes with a form, because I do like to write in form. So So sometimes I'm writing a poem just because I'm going to try a sonnet, I'm going to try a guzzle, I'm going to try a pantoum. So that does happen sometimes. I think more often it begins for me with sound. So I'll hear a phrase, an interesting phrase, or just something over here on the bus, or even something on the radio. And especially if it has a rhythm, that phrase will just stick with me, and I'll begin to build a poem around it. So it's often beginning with a phrase.
All right. What are some of the predominant themes in your work?
Oh, that's a good one. To think
All right.
about, think back over my poems and my predominant themes. You know, I think I like to write about resilience. That seems to come up in my work a lot. Resilience,
okay.
hope, definitely. Sometimes I just like to write about a little moment or a little something that I see or come across that reveals an extreme situation. You know, it's not a big event, but it gives a window into something, into a bigger story or a bigger situation, sometimes an injustice. So I think that's kind of a theme. Women, like to write about women. Lately, I'm finding I turned 60 recently, so lately I have a lot of things about aging. Thank you.
Yes, I know that feeling. Yes.
Yes, you know.
Yes,
so you know, aging, looking back, I've found I'm writing about that. And then a kind of funny one. I noticed a while ago, looking at my poems, I have a lot of poems about waking up in the morning, you know, literally waking up and getting out of bed. I'm not a morning person, so I don't know. Somehow that's a theme sometimes. Yeah. So those are some.
Okay. Well, share another of your works.
I will. All right. See. I think I'll share this poem called How Can It Be? Because it has to do with resilience. How can it be? The only way to have hope, how can it be, is to walk into the street, not as a beggar, not as one crushed to a shadow, holding a cup, begging for bread or a place to stand, but to walk like a man in a parade, pockets full of candy to toss to children as you pass, as if lit from within. As if joy were a friend you can call on any time, even days you're too sad to dress or untangle your hair. Pull on a bright shirt and walk out as if heading to joy's house for tea and a chat. Joy might still turn you from her door that day, but I know hope will catch up with you, hook your arm, her arm through yours, and match your stride, even if neither of you can speak.
When did you first start writing, Naomi? And what made you feel the need to express yourself this way?
What made me feel it? Well, let's see. I think I was about in my early teens. You know, I was interested in poetry when I was younger, but probably started when I was about 12 or 13. And I feel like people either get hooked into poetry by, you know, it's often either by the sound, the music element, or the meaning element, kind of the way you can convey things. You can get a different message in poems. And the sound and the meaning element have to meld. But people seem to either, you know, sort of come in either route, either through the sound and the music that hooks them, or the fact that you can express a message. I got hooked by the sound. It was definitely by coming in interested in music and sound.
Mm-hmm.
And I really loved music. I always have. And when I was a kid, I played a lot of instruments. Played violin, viola, mandolin, and I loved to sing. That was just my life was music. But for some reason, when I was about 12 or 13, I stopped playing all the instruments. You know, people let those things go. That's about when I really started getting really interested in listening to poetry. And so I kind of went from the, you know, the music to the language music. And that's when I switched from music. And then I've written pretty much since I was 13 or 14, with brief stops, but pretty much always since then. It's just part of life.
All right. Well, share another piece of your work.
I will. And, you know, I think I wanted to say, too, the poem I just read, How Can It Be? It's interesting. I was thinking, because you asked me how does a poem form. That one, rare. It's one of the rare things. I woke up and it was almost completely there. It literally, when I woke out of bed, that poem was kind of just in my head. But they usually don't come out that easily.
Okay, I can understand.
Yeah, I think I'll read. I'm gonna read another poem from my latest book, which is called She Was a Cathedral, and it's all poems about women, either women I've known or. Sometimes famous women or women I've just come across. The idea is that the women are cathedrals. So this is a poem from that, from about a friend of mine named Bonnie, who is a therapist. And it's called Trumpet Vine. Trumpet Vine. When I think of an image for the signature you trail across this world, I see a trumpet vine. I've watched you twist your way over cracked walls like grace with a wire down its middle. You turn the living rooms of gritty houses like ours into swirling dance floors, pulled edge lurkers, shoulders slouched over old loneliness, into the center to whirl in light with you. Your hands, vigorous as those orange flowers, push back barrenness. Wherever it yawns, you brought your brash curl of faith into circles of boys sitting hard-eyed against cinder blocks, 16-year-olds who'd assaulted 14-year-olds. You wouldn't shrivel. You got them to talk, to hold to the light a swatch of true color, theirs. When you say he's withered you, this husband who left you, I say, look how high this vine is, how many flowers thrust bright hands into the day.
You know, when you think about... Okay, please. Please continue.
Am I reeling loud enough? Can you hear? Can it be heard well?
Yes, it's perfect, perfect, perfect.
Excellent.
You know, when you think about...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
When you think about your friend being a therapist, May is National Mental Health Awareness Month, and I think poetry probably saved many lives.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's really interesting to think about that. That's really true. Do you mind if I tell a little tiny story about Jimmy Santiago Baca?
No, please, whatever you like.
It connects to what you just said, and he's the one I read the quote about a poem will release a sparkling fountain of energy. And one reason that quote struck me is he's a poet who started out as a 17-year-old. He was in prison. He's talked about this in interviews, and he'd given up. He was like a, you know, juvenile delinquent. He was in prison, and he was such a hard ass, he would fight anybody. And he said that he didn't care if he lived or died. That's why he was not afraid to fight. And one time while he was in prison, only 17, he got hold of a book, and he said the book made him think about his grandfather. He wanted to finish reading the book, and he desperately wanted to start writing. He'd never written, but he wanted to write about his grandfather. The next day, he says, someone in the prison challenged him to fight. And for the first time, he didn't take the bait because for the first time, he wanted to live. And he said he was afraid to fight because he might die and he might not be able to start writing about his grandfather. So I just, when you said that about poetry saving lives, for him, it gave him that impetus to not want to fight, but to want to live and to want to create something. And
yes,
I just love that story. That's why he's one of the poets I love.
Yes, I enjoy his work as well. Please share another of your works.
Okay, should I do a short one or a longer one?
Whichever you like. The hour is yours.
Oh, leave it to me. Okay.
Yes.
I think I'll read this longer, slightly longer one. This poem is, I've written a book called In Yolo County that is the book tells in poems the story about my grandparents having a courtship in Woodland, California in the 1920s. So this poem has to do with my grandfather. He, in the 20s, he was he left home when he was about 13 or 14. He lived in Minnesota in a big family. He left. He didn't exactly run away, but he wanted adventure. So he left and for years just kind of bummed around the U.S. As a teen and in his 20s, odd jobs, you know, kind of be almost like a hobo till he got to California. So at that time, my grandfather, whose name was Curly, he would do what he called ride the rails. He'd just jump on freight trains on a boxcar,
yeah,
ride wherever the car took him, and jump off. And a lot of hobos did that. So this poem is called In a Boxcar, 1928. And I'm trying to imagine what it really must have been like to ride the rails in the 20s.
Mm-hmm.
In a Boxcar, 1928. Odd thoughts jolt through a man's head riding the rails, jammed with 40 others in a flat wheeler. Hard bouncing, can't stand straight, the ride's so rough. Old scraps surface to the rails' rhythm. Candy is dandy, but liquor is quicker. Candy is dandy, but liquor is quicker. Rougher than a cob and wilder than a woodchuck. In a boxcar, stale rage lifts off men's packed shoulders, hangs like dust in hot air. A hungry man praying to make it to California with no knife fight hears in his head, "You're going to hell in a handbasket, like a one-legged man in a butt-kicking contest." He remembers fried chicken, tablecloth, the legs of women in stockings. And now with somebody's wool shirt against his face, dozing as his head bangs, he dreams he crawls right to the edge of the world, like the edge of the open boxcar, death's bin below, and crawls back, backward, over and over again. And in his head, "You're just shitting in one hand and wishing in the other. 'Twill do you no good to kick against the traces." That poem uses some slang from the 20s, because I love to use slang in my poems, and it was fun to bring in some of that older, you know, those older expressions and odd slang that you just don't hear so much anymore.
You know, poets hail from all over the world. Where do you hail from?
Good question. my home is here in Washington, D.C. area, Virginia and Washington, but that's because I made it my home. So I really was born in Seattle, lived in California till I was about 7, but I mostly grew up in Pittsburgh. So Pittsburgh is my hometown. Yeah, and I have a lot of affection for it. But I've lived here since 1980, so this area feels like home.
Right. You know, they say that in this world, to operate with complete honesty, you should look to comedians, artists, and poets. What do you think emerges naturally from your work? You've had collections and books. What emerges naturally from who you are as a poet?
Mm-hmm. What emerges naturally?
Yes.
I heard you right. Yeah.
Yes.
First of all, I love that quote, that thing about looking to the comedians and the poets. That's fantastic.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't really know how to answer that. What emerges naturally?
Mm-hmm.
I think it probably has to do with the themes I write about. I hope that what emerges naturally is sound, music, you know, music that captivates people.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope kind of like the details and the contours of people's stories that you don't normally hear about, you know, the kind of people off in the corners. I do tend to sometimes write about kind of underdogs and situations you wouldn't normally be thinking about, and I try and make some characters, so I hope those stories of people, and I hope and resilience. I hope those emerge. It's kind of hard to know yourself, you know, what emerges. That's my hope.
Right. I can understand. You know, all great writers have great writing influences. Who are some of yours, and what makes them great in your eyes?
Influences, okay. Well, there's a lot of people I love to read, so it's a little hard to narrow down. I like Denise Levertov. Denise Levertov is a poet that you just don't, I don't think you hear about her quite as much. And also Maxine Cumin. She's someone I've been reading a lot lately. They both just have really wonderful imagery, kind of right in the vernacular. Maxine Cumin has a lot of great poems about nature and the land, because she was on lived on a farm in New Hampshire a lot of her life. So kind of like Mary Oliver, she's wonderful at writing about, you know, the real deal about nature. So I love Maxine Cumin. I love Phil Levine. I hope I've been influenced by him. He's a poet that writes a lot about working class people. He's from that kind of background, worked in factories a lot of his life in the 30s and 40s. And he's got a lot of that in his poems. He writes about his own life, but he also is able to bring in, just, again, many other people's lives that you wouldn't hear as much about, working class lives. So those are some influences. And I love Neruda, Pablo Neruda. Do you ever read Neruda?
Yes.
It's hard to even say what I like about him, you know, because he's just so fabulous. What can you say? It's like Walt Whitman. What can you say? You know? He's so lush. He's just so lush. Yeah. And I want to mention that one of my best poetry teachers ever, because she's been an influence both as a poet and very much as a teacher. When I studied at George Mason, I had Susan Tishy, the poet, as a teacher. She's recently retired. All my teachers there were good, but boy, she was a great influence. Taught me so much. She was fantastic.
All right. Very nice. Very nice.
Can I mention two more?
Yes, please.
I'll be quick. You asked me. I just want to mention two of my influences that are musicians, Laura Nyro and Bruce Coburn. Fantastic lyrics, and they're two singer-songwriters that are just very influential to me. So.
All right, let's take a brief
break.
We'll
be right
back.
Thank you.
No, it's perfect. We'll be right back. If you'd like to call in and ask Naomi a question. Naomi, please share another of your works.
I will. Thank you. I think I'm going to read another one about my grandfather. I've got a book that's about my grandparents' courtship in the 1920s in Woodland, California. So this is in the voice of my grandfather. His name was Curly.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandmother was Alberta, and he was courting her. They called her Bertie. And her family did not like him, as you will hear.
Okay.
Her German family did not like my grandfather. So this is his voice, and it's called Hard. Hard. It shouldn't have been so hard. I traveled a sobering road. I knew my mind. I could tell as soon as I met Bertie, about the first time we laid a makeshift picnic by the river and she leaned against my shoulder, that we would suit. A steady girl, Bertie, worked like a tireless boy, but a light step walking the path to the river. Woodland was stretching out in 28, rolling out new sidewalks, like to scoop up any drifter who sat down too long. I could see the years to come clear as her slim hips ahead on the path. For a man willing to cease his rambling, to tend an endless line in a cannery or a field, a place. Maybe I would do it. But to Bertie's hawk-nosed papa, I was poison. A rail rider, landless, not German. Christ, He was a hard old man, always thumping his hand on the armchair as he rocked on the porch, sputtering about the Reds making trouble in Fresno, or about his dutiful daughter who put the family first. Bertie signed on to work at the bakery to get away from her dad's high-toned rant. If I hadn't been able to see her there Saturday afternoons, the air full of cinnamon, I don't know. I would slouch against the counter with the coffee, my hands gouged from canning or pruning grapes, but my breath easy, the room warm, Bertie joshed with folks. I felt good in Woodland. Maybe I should have waited till her papa came around. But the day he called me mouth to feed sealed it. I would find a way to make a home with Bertie, but never in her own backyard. Hmm. And my grandparents did end up eloping. They had to go to Reno because her family was so disapproving. That was what you did in those days. You eloped to Reno in 1929.
Yeah. All right. You know, you're a great guest. I like your energy, the way that you I can tell that you love poetry. That you
I
love
do.
The rhythm of it, the sound of it. It just comes through in every one of your pieces.
Oh, thank you, Michael. I do.
Yes, I can tell. You know, you've published extensively. Are your books available on Amazon?
I think so. Yes, they should be. My first one is. It's with Washington Writers Publishing House.
Mm-hmm.
Called Only the Raw Hands Are Heaven. So I know that's on Amazon. And then I have two books with Finishing Line Press.
Mm-hmm.
So if they're not on Amazon, you can find them by going to www.finishinglinepress.com. And I have one called She Was a Cathedral. And then the one about my grandparents is just called In Yolo County. So they should
nice.
Be available. Mm-hmm.
Does knowing that your poems are published and out there in the world validate your being a poet, or are you content knowing that they're out of your system?
Ooh, that's a really good question. I think I'd say, you know, it does validate it a little, yes. You know, it'd be nice to say, oh, no, nobody cares about that. And I
mm-hmm.
think I would write no matter what, certainly at this point. I would keep writing no matter what, but... You know, it does validate it to have it published and you feel like you're not just writing in a vacuum.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you were meant to be a poet?
No, I actually don't think I would say that. I think I chose it. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
I chose it. Yeah. It's hard to say. And I do also write to get them out of my system, too. There's something to that, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes. I can understand.
Is that,
well, please share another piece of your work. Yes, that's perfect. Perfect answer.
Right. Okay, I'm going to share, I think, let's see, what shall I share? I'm going to read a short one that actually is a poem from my significant other, and it's about him reading his poetry, and he actually is going to be on the show. He's going to be one of your guests on this, the podcast, I'm sorry, the radio show. So this is for my partner Gregory Luce, and it's called Watching You Give a Reading. Watching you give a reading. Knowing what I know of the cracked infrastructure beneath, the sparking of frayed wires, beams, even a foundation buckling under their long-held burdens, the warped walls, the broken signal, makes it sweeter to see you stride up to a podium, speak to the gathered crowd, and lift their spirits, reset their thermostat with the poems you choose, but also with the bugle of your smile. Hope enters the room almost unnoticed with the last straggles of audience. I meet your eyes, blue as any 20-year-old.
That was really nice. I like that.
Thank you. Another one,
right,
thinking much. About getting older.
Yes. Yes. What do you see as being the role of a poet? This may be a question with a long answer, but what do you see as being the role of a poet in modern day society?
Well, I think I would just think about that, but I think I would go back to that idea I talked about before about giving people energy, giving people a new way to see things, kind of a way to shake up your perceptions. There's a lot I could say about that. A lot of poets have talked about, you know, how poetry should sort of, I think Emily Dickinson said something like it should make your skin tingle, or I'm not remembering right, but you should feel as if your nerves are on fire when you're really reading poetry. So, you know, I think it can bring an internal change to people. A lot of people ask, oh, does poetry really change things? I think it can bring an internal change. Definitely when you write it, you know, I feel very different when I'm writing. And I think it can bring energy. It can bring beauty, you know. We need more beauty.
Yes, we do.
And it can,
yes, we do.
It can get messages across. I think it can bypass some things and get some things that need to be said out to society. Because the music going with it might make it a little easier to take some messages, and it certainly brings to light. So does that give a sense, an answer?
Yes, it does. That's very eloquently stated. You know, you've had opportunities to read your work in front of different audiences. What is the relationship between your speaking voice and your written voice?
Well, I think I'd say they're pretty much the same, mostly. I don't use, you know, elevated poetic language when I write. You know, I kind of write in the vernacular, conversational, even if I'm doing sort of a persona poem. It's probably still a lot, you know, a bit of my voice. So I'm not writing in any, you know, specific diction. It's pretty vernacular. Mm-hmm. I do think that when I speak, I tend to be maybe a little rambling, you know. I tend to go off on a few tangents. You know, people speak that way, a little disorganized maybe. But then, of course, my writing, when you're writing, it's a chance to, it has to be shaped. It has to be organized. You know, you can, even if you're sounding conversational, it's very shaped. So I think maybe I would say my writing voice is like my speaking voice, but shaped and maybe kind of focused.
Well, share another piece of your work.
All right. Let's see. What shall I read? I'm going to read one that's in a form. Sort of starts like a sonnet, but it's a loose sonnet. It starts that way, but it's looser. But you'll hear it's in a form because I just love form. So this is about my daughter when she was a baby and a friend was watching her. I was actually going to a poetry reading and my friend watched her. It's called Watching Susanna in the Storm for Lisa Friedman. And it has an epigraph. Why does God let a mortal man have children? It is senseless to love anything this much. By Barbara Kingsolver. Watching Susanna in the Storm. As rain rocks the earth like a judgment, you turn in your woven basket of fever. Like a fish twisting in wicker, you do not wake, but slip past sickness and down a cool river. I fear you, fragile, senseless one. Since my own mother left me, I have never poured all my love into one vessel with a hole in the bottom. I have kept one hand always in my pocket. I think of my friend who watched you tonight, held you like earth rocking its fragile spring. The seeds of mortality livening her tongue and the changes singing in her blood might bring her down with all her brave luck by the day she's my age. And they tell me I am young. She is the friend who taught me to breathe water, to roll along earth's crust, a wave always arcing to break, to lean back, writing poems that change nothing, and listen to rain rocking my child to sleep.
You know, honey, your poems have... Okay, please.
I was we're both eager to talk.
Yes. I'm excited.
I was just going to mention, I read that at a reading once, and that someone was struck by the line, "I've kept one hand always in my pocket." And it was very cool because he wrote a poem around that line that he sent to me. That was just it was a wonderful way of, you know, feeling it passed on.
Yes. You know, your poems are amazingly, the titles are amazing. What role should a title play with a, in a poem or a poem? The title.
What role should the title play?
Yes.
Yeah, interesting, because some writers don't even really give titles, so that's an interesting thought. Yeah. Well, I do think about my titles. Sometimes it's the last thing to go on there.
Mm-hmm.
I'll have to think a little more about that. I think it kind of gives a signal, you know, a way of framing what's coming after.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the title is not deceitful, but it's kind of signaling you in a subtle way, so you have to really think a little bit after the poem, well, what is this about? You know, is there something deeper going on here? Sometimes the title can signal you to something a little deeper.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's setting the stage, I guess, like in A Boxcar 1928. You know, when I'm not there to explain that poem and someone might be reading it, they need to know we're in a boxcar and, you know, this is what's going on, writing in a boxcar. So it can be a signal that way. And sometimes it's just maybe it's extending the sound of the music. You know, a beautiful title can, I don't know, it can be a further thing to draw you into the music and the sound.
Very nice.
It's an interesting question. You know, I've never heard anybody talk about the title, so, you know, and really give that some thought.
Make me think. All right. You know, many poets have different methods for their writing. Some write on paper.
Mm-hmm.
And transfer from paper to the computer. What is your style of preferred writing? The computer, paper?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think I'm just not a digital. I'm not a digital native, you know.
Okay.
I write with the pen. I really write with the pen. When I'm composing, you know, when I'm first starting to write something, there's just a way when I'm thinking, when I'm making something, the pen is just part of it. You know, so I've got to be writing with the pen. It's kind of, you know, it's very physical. Then I'll type it eventually, of course, and I'll revise it, you know, when I type it. And I'm revising a lot. When I write with the pen, I just kind of, you know, it varies, but often I just kind of let the words flow out.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's very slow and I'm rewriting. There's a lot of revising, you know. But I'll try out different things. I'll put different things out. But I pretty much do most of the composing, you know, pen and paper. Some people really suggest you should read out loud when you're composing, and I have a hard time. Sometimes I do that, you know, to hear the sound.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes it a little hard to read out loud when you're composing, depending where you are, too.
You know, that sounds like the title of a poem, I Write with a Pen. It's very...
That's really interesting. I think I'll write that.
Well, do, please. And I'd love to hear it. I'd love to hear it. And I'll invite you back.
I write with a pen.
It
can go a lot of ways. Yeah, I really could.
You can. Well, please share another piece of your work. Thank you so much. Please share another piece.
Sure. Okay. I'm going to read another one for a friend of mine. This is also from She Was a Cathedral, my book about poems about women, and this is also for a friend of mine. She, like me, is a divorced mom, and when her kids were little and we would compare notes, she would often say, "Oh, I'm just going to pray for peace, balance, and progress. That's what I need in life, peace, balance, and progress." So that was one of those phrases that stuck with me. So this is called I Heard You Pray for Peace, Balance, and Progress. Not rivulets, not waves of food-crusted dishes, not columns of bills and clutter on the stairway, not three flat tires, not eight flooded cupboards, not your son's Mobius strip of questions, not his 19th rowdy scream for attention, rattling your every other rooted tooth, not clusters of cockroaches, not the rages, the lies, the stick-to-right angles, but bend-to-me demands of your ex-demented husband. Not your mother's arched eyebrow on the side of said husband. Not self-doubt, not time warps, not online predation can stop the motion of your progress and the progress of your peace. I hope some of the resilience came through in that poem. That
yes.
poem to me is about her resilience and her not stopping. And I found even using the repetition, it's kind of a form, all the repetition there,
mm-hmm.
that even was, I think, was coming to me because of that idea of not stopping and keep your progress going.
Right. What makes a good poem? What makes a good poem? What makes a poem good?
Yeah. Wow. That is a $10,000 question. That is a really tough one, Michael. You know, that is really tough. And I honestly don't really like to answer questions like that too much because
yes.
there's so much mystique around. I don't know, you know, like, are you an artist? Are you not an artist? Can you write poetry?
Mm-hmm.
Can you not? Are you a real poet? Are you not a real poet? Are
yes.
you just fooling around? And, you know, I will give you some answer, but I think it's there's a lot of subjectivity there. And I don't like to say any kind of definite, this is a good poem, this is not a good poem, because,
mm-hmm.
you know, then people think they're on one side or line or the other if they want to write. Am I good? Am I not good? If you want to keep writing, you'll get better, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think some good things that do make a good poem that maybe transcend, you know, there's obviously different poems are considered good at different times, different styles. But, you know, there's got to be some kind of music, some kind of, not a regular rhythm, but an enhanced rhythm, a rhythm that you can hear and that captures you in some way.
Mm-hmm.
The language is in some way enhanced. You know, you're not just putting down some lines like you're talking. It's enhanced, it's shaped, there's some music, there's some rhythm, and usually, you know, some vibrant images. And it should shake you up a little, you know, I would say. Make
mm-hmm.
you think, shake you up a little, even just by the loveliness or the, you know, the power of the music. Something should shake you up. So I think that's as far as I would go on saying what's a good poem. Other than that, you know, it's whatever works and whatever is making somebody feel moved.
Yes, I can understand. I like that.
Yeah.
Right, and you're right. It's a very subjective.
How would you answer that question? I'm just curious. Would you have a thought of what makes a good poem?
I could say very simply, whatever makes you happy. Whatever
mm-hmm.
makes you, poetry to me is a lived experience. So it's an opportunity mm-hmm. for you to share, whether you want to share or not. But I think I'm no longer going to ask that question. Because you're right,
mm-hmm.
it's very subjective. And
mm-hmm.
I can't answer it either. Because it's just too
mm-hmm.
much goes into writing, to sharing your work.
Right.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Naomi. Thank you very, very much. I'm not going to ask that question anymore. That is stricken from the record.
Oh, no, I didn't mean to suggest you not ask. I didn't mean that at all. Oh, no, no. Many people would have a wonderful answer. Because it's a really interesting thing to think about, you know, what makes something even a poem or not a poem. You know, it's a fascinating question. So I hope you don't strike it.
Okay. But see, I can't answer it. I can't answer it either.
It's a tough one. And it's like thinking about, you know, what makes a great painting. Well, for so many years, nobody would buy Van Gogh's paintings. He sold one painting
mm-hmm.
his entire life. And people would have said he's not a great painter at all. You know,
mm-hmm.
so, yeah, that kind of subjectivity.
All right. You know, all poets have several words that come up over and over and over again, words or sentences that they can't help but use in their work. What are three of your absolute favorite words to use in your work?
Wow, that's really, I have to think about that. That's interesting. Yeah, because I think that's really true. People have words they love over and over.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I actually do like to use the word hope.
Okay.
I will actually have that in my poems a lot. I think I'd have to look through and find those words. It's kind of hard to remember that in your own, you know, in your own writing. Definitely hope. I have certain sounds I like. It almost sounds more than words. You know, I like to use a lot of assonants. I like to use the short sound a lot. That seems to come up a lot. You know, it almost sounds more than that. And I love to use iambic pentameter. I love to use that. I think it's kind of hard to say the words. I'd really have to think more about that one.
Okay. All right. Well, let's take a brief
sounds
break.
That come up.
Yes, let's take a brief break, and we'll be right back.
All right.
Anthony Ingram, I'm here with Naomi Tears, and we're having a great time. A great time sharing and talking about the art and craft of poetry. Mm-hmm. Naomi, has your idea of what poetry is and what poetry can do changed since you began writing at the age of 12?
I don't think quite so much. No, I don't think so, because...
Okay.
I don't really analyze it a lot, you know. I just really love to be in it. I love to be in it writing the poems. I think maybe I've realized more that, like, how shall I say, the changes it makes in me. You know, that's changed. It's not just all this kind of hobby that I would try it. I've realized more that it can change my perceptions. I don't think so much about what poetry is. Not really. Just that I've learned different forms. I've learned different, you know, different things to try, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, share another piece of your work.
I'm going to share one that's relatively recent, and it's just one of those little stories I was mentioning. I often get a kernel of an idea to write something that tells a little story that many people might not see. So this... is about one of my neighbors. I live in a condo, and the neighbor right below me, his balcony is right below mine. He has an unusual hobby, and I'm sure he's not allowed to have this hobby by the condo laws. it is
hopefully
beautiful.
Hopefully he's not listening.
He's not. And it's a good hobby. It's a good hobby.
Okay, all right.
You'll hear. So it's called Release. Release. You never see a baby pigeon, my dad used to say. The truth is, they are half rats and their chicks fledge in the sewers. A bird curse if noticed at all, like flying litter in an urban day, unwanted as hotel art. But not Hussein's pigeons, not Hussein's joy. Have you seen two slim white and cinnamon birds, wing to wing, fly a purposeful arc around a brick apartment building, their high-lit grace like two sentient leaves tracing a circle through late evening sky, dipping and skimming, still twinned to land on a man's outstretched arm, on his white shirt sleeve? Have you seen his dark, dapper face split in half by a smile? An ordinary man, a teacher in Karachi, now a taxi driver with a quiet wife and four boys living in a two-bedroom apartment. A place of scarred bunk beds, bins, kids smacking each other. But on Hussein's high balcony, contraband in a white crate. This orderly man breaks rules with six people living in 1,500 square feet, with his sons biking through the parking lot, but mostly with his birds, who swiftly slice our inner suburb sky every evening, circle and home, circle and home. At times, they land on my balcony rail, strut and tilt their fine chocolate heads, their feathers soft and clean. And the little boys crowd at the rail below mine. They crane their necks up and giggle. Don't tell. And I won't tell, for I love this sight. Pigeon grace. I love that I have seen a pigeon, chick, held in his toweled palm, pale as dirty ice, craning its neck. I love to see him lift his arm in the relief. His sleight of hand, his sip of joy.
You know, when I post my poems or when I write, I have a habit of writing three at a time. Do you have a special ritual that you go through when preparing to write? A special ritual?
No, that's interesting. No, I don't. I actually thought about that when I was thinking about questions you might ask. I do not have any ritual. I will write almost anywhere that I, you know, that I can, that I have time, and I have a pen. I could write almost anywhere. Except I will tell you, I hate to write sitting at a desk. That's the one place I just feel like I don't want to write when I'm sitting at a desk, maybe because I work at a desk. So... but I don't have a special ritual. I like to write in the morning often, but I can you know, just about anywhere, really.
Are you a member of a writing group?
Yes. We're not meeting too much, but yes. People that I studied with at George Mason, so we've been sharing our work for a long time, and that's really a really useful thing. I just, you know, it's hard to write when you don't get any feedback or any response, and that's really a great group.
All right. Well, speaking of writing, please share another piece of your work.
Right. I'm going to read one called The Other Side from a book called Only the Raw Hands Are Heaven. So I spent some time in Juarez, Mexico. I was working in a shelter there for people from Mexico who had migrated to Juarez, and there was also a sister shelter for immigrants from Central America who were trying to get to the U.S. So, you know, because of the situation of asylum seekers now, it's been on my mind a lot, people coming from Central America. So this poem, the speaker, is a person trying to get into the U.S., coming on a Greyhound bus. And when you ride a Greyhound bus, which I've done from Mexico to the U.S., the immigration agents will come on the bus and check people's papers, and they'll just pull you off if you don't have the right papers. So that's the background. The other side. When the light hit my eyes, I was dreaming of the scarlet velvet spread on the widest bed I've ever slept in. That hotel in Santa Ana on my wedding night, like taking her wrapped in a cloud of wine. On the churning Greyhound pulled over outside to come carry, my legs went slack as a river. I'd made it. The hurt fists held between my knees remembered Lupita's breath. I didn't see the flashlight moving row down row on the faces. Their command, I made part of my dream. Papers, papeles. Didn't see until I was in it. Didn't see the hands until they went for my armpits. Like the large, shined fingers of the hotel owner I saw that next morning, thrusting a cigarette still in his other hand, into the blouse of my bride. So that was a obviously kind of a persona poem. I find sometimes I just find myself writing in the voice of another character.
Yes. What do you want your poetry to do, and where do you want it to go?
I think I wanted to, I'll just repeat myself. I wanted to bring energy to people, bring delight.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to go, wherever someone might find it, and hopefully bring someone a different way of looking at something, a different way of thinking about something, some energy.
Mm-hmm.
And really, I hope it makes them want to write poetry themselves. I hope it gives them the itch, or at least to do something creative, to feel that,
mm-hmm.
that they could, they can write too, and to get energy from that. So I think that's where I would say I would want my poetry to go.
All right. Some poets are also active in other creative areas. What are some of your favorite non-poetry or literature activities?
Walking, hiking in the woods. And I still love music, so singing.
Mm.
Exercising, yoga, of course, yoga. I'm learning to play the Irish frame drum, which is something I wanted to do for a long time. It's called the Bowron. So I have a lot of Irish ancestry, and I've always wanted to learn this instrument. So that's one of my favorite things now, playing the Bowron. And being with my friends,
mm-hmm.
And reading, of course. Reading, reading a lot of fiction and poetry myself.
Do you read works similar to your own or completely different?
I think I just read what I come across. It's often pretty different. Yeah, often it's different. Hard to say. I love to read Spanish poetry too. I love to read poetry in the original Spanish. I get a different sense of it that way. So.
Yes. Please share one more. As we're about to close out, please share one more.
I will. And it's funny because you were asking me earlier, what are some of the words that appear in my poetry a lot? I thought of another one, and that's the title of this poem. For some reason, I like the word flick. I use that word flick. So this poem is Flick. This is also in the book about my grandparents in Yolo County. And it's about my grandfather, Curly, working on a farm, and he had an industrial accident that could have gone really badly. Flick. Think of it. How the flick of an arm, the random glare of the sun, the angle of a young farmhand's elbow or bunch of his cuff, as he reaches in carelessly to pull a clog of hay from a chugging baler, can twist a man's promise or an unknown family's history forever. The clang of sun just bright enough to blind his view, the cuff just close enough to the gear to be grabbed by relentless metal, the arm pulled deeper into grinding gear, pulled nearly to the obliterating teeth as Curly screams and yanks back, panic force, seeing the foreman lunge to flick the switch. Curly fears, a solid man, not a fool, not a drunk, just eager to end a day bailing under blazing sun in Alturas, now stares at his bloody show of an arm, feels pain ripping like avenging bees. There slips across his mind before he blacks out. It's still there, but the blood's flowing like Niagara. When he wakes to a narrow iron bed in the farmer's house, his arm a white swathed ache, flash memories of being carried, of a strange man's hands on him. Questions teeter like the last card placed on a trembling tower. How fierce the infection, how steady his will. Will he see 1930 come? Yeah, it was interesting when I started writing about my family. I heard a lot of family stories I'd never heard before. I'd never heard that story about my grandfather. And one of the great things, if you're, you know, writing about your family and your ancestors, you learn things.
Yes, you do. When the very last question, when people hear your work, they usually want more. What's next for you as a poet?
Well, I'm hoping to get another book published, so I've got a collection I'm sending around. Got a lot more poems coming, I think, about those changes, those life changes, you know, aging. I think that's a thing we don't have enough poems about, really, is when people are very much older and how life goes. So writing some of that, and I think I'm starting to write some shorter poems. I'm experimenting with haiku, which I never have written very much of. I tend to write longer things. So that's a direction I'm going in, those shorter things. Mm-hmm. And then we'll see. We'll just see, we'll see what comes up.
I like your attitude. We'll see what comes up. I want to thank you, Naomi. You've been the perfect guest, and I've enjoyed this hour, and I'm sure that our listening audience has enjoyed it as well. So thank you so much, and I'd like you to return in the future.
Oh, well, you're welcome, and thank you for the opportunity. It was wonderful to have a chance. Thank you, Michael.
All right. Okay, have a good evening. Thank you. And good night to everyone.
Bye-bye. Good night. We'll be right back.